Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisy.
And we are the Shock Doctors. In this episode, we're going to be discussing Old, which is, an M. Night Shyamalan film.
You know who M. Night Shyamalan is. We're going to try to get through this whole episode without saying what a twist or Shyamalama ding dong or any of the dead horse goofs about poor put upon M. Night that have been circulating for
I see
like
dead on arrival
now.
Movies.
Ah, very good.
Yes, right. So this movie was kept pretty aggressively under wraps until the Super Bowl when, as far as I know, like a full-length trailer aired as one of the obligatory Super Bowl commercials. I did not watch it. I have actually, or had actually, successfully avoided watching any trailers for this movie.
I never took you for such an M. Night purist.
I mean, I'm not. I just, when I say successfully avoided, I mean, I didn't try that hard. You know, it's not like I went to see a movie and they're playing a trailer for Old and I, like, ran out
right
for 60 seconds.
Yeah,
or,
I guess that's what I was imagining,
or whatever.
Just because we see so many horror movies in theaters, I guess it had just as much to do with luck of the draw in your case.
Right. I mean, yeah, trailer for this movie didn't play in front of anything I saw, and then I definitely didn't go looking. And, yeah, I didn't look anything up about this movie. I knew the basic premise, which is there's a beach that makes you old really fast. And that's the crux of the movie, really.
Yeah, it's a pretty goofy, high-concept elevator pitch. It really is all you need to know. I mean, you would have a much harder time pitching Glass, for example.
Right.
Glass
it's
is a... Is
hard
a...
to condense that down. So anyway, obviously M. Night has had an up-and-down career. The aughts were mostly about the downs, at least the later aughts. He had a bit of a renaissance after The Visit came out, and then Split, and then longtime listeners will know more or less how we feel about Glass, which is mostly nothing good.
Yeah, it poisoned the well for me, pretty much. I mean, the vicissitudes of his career are such that there really isn't consensus anymore, as far as I can see.
I wouldn't think so.
After Sixth Sense, he could do no wrong. And then for the better part of a decade, he could do no right. And now it really depends on who you ask. Even Glass was divisive. It had its defenders. I was not among them.
Right. Neither one of us was. But that is true. Some people did like Glass. And I think we should ship those people to the old beach.
I liked things about Glass. More on that after the break, maybe.
Or just go back and listen to episode, I don't know, 12 or whatever it was.
Okay.
A ways back.
I can feel the sand between my toes. You can't say those things to me. I'm aging at what they spend so much goddamn time in this movie hashing out the exact exchange rate. I've already forgotten it. Half an hour.
Well, because it doesn't matter.
No, and it's the way that it's implemented is pretty scattershot, which I don't necessarily hate, but more later.
Yes.
So we open with a nuclear family arriving at a resort for their summer vacation, and the four of them, it all seems fairly idyllic. We figure out fairly quickly that there are marital issues and they're planning to separate after this vacation. They just wanted to give the family one last outing as a cohesive group for the kids' sake. The kids are, what, 6 and 10, respectively?
10 or 11.
And they make a couple friends running around the resort. The younger of the two, the boy, makes friends with the nephew of the guy who runs the resort.
The boy, Trent, mostly demands friendship.
Nobody writes precocious movie children more annoyingly than M. Night Shyamalan. Precocious movie children are among the most annoying of movie tropes, and he is just way out in front in terms of cranking the obnoxiousness up to 11. It's horrid.
Well, and on top of everything else, and we can get into this more after the break, I feel like M. Night has always had kind of a weird ear for dialogue.
Oh, yes.
You know, the way that people talk to each other has never been wholly natural, but that's way more true in this movie than in past movies. Like, you don't really notice it.
Happening, notwithstanding, but well, barring sure, that, sure. I think I would agree with you.
But, you know, like an Unbreakable or a Sixth Sense or The Village or whatever, I mean, the conversation is more or less natural, but... You know, this movie is like the old beach is in the middle of the uncanny valley.
Yes, and that kind of wound up working for me, and we'll get there when we get there. But it is, you do get the exchanges in this movie that you will remember, perhaps not fondly, maybe fondly, from The Happening, where, you know, no, ma'am, we're not. Like that kind of thing, where it's just, oh, this was written by an alien. This was written by... an alien smashing its tentacles against the keyboard. This doesn't make a lick of sense. These aren't human beings. And there can be some pleasure in that. I think that the premise justifies it here more so than it ever did in The Happening, unless the invisible plant spores in The Happening were also precipitously dropping everyone's IQ, and the movie just never pointed that out, which is unlikely given Shyamalan's love of exposition.
Right.
So... Trent and Maddox are the two precocious tots' names. Trent's first line of dialogue is, I think verbatim, I didn't write this one down, but it's stuck in my brain like a burr. He says, her spontaneity has been stripped away from her.
Mom.
Does that ring a bell? Yeah. It's like, son, you're six. It's like Village of the Damned. It's like they're precocious to the point of eeriness. And I think Shyamalan thinks it's cute. I mean, there's pauses after all of his lines, like there should be sitcom laughter getting piped in. And often the adults in the movie will, like, smile to one another, like, oh, how precious. No.
No, it's awful.
It's really spooky. So they make friends with the nephew, and the two of them, Trent and the other kid whose name escapes me, they trade notes back and forth.
How could it escape you? His name is Idlib.
Idlib,
we talked,
yes,
about this.
Well, yeah, that, it's,
as in the city in Syria.
I thought, and the guy who runs the resort is just powerfully Swedish, Nordic.
Some kind of Nordic, yes.
He
Scandinavian.
And the kid is not. Yeah. And so I thought, oh, did he abduct this kid from, like, one of the families that he olded? Like, that's kind of interesting. The movie never comes right out and says as much, and knowing Shyamalan, it would.
Right, that's the thing. Like, in another movie, you could come away from it thinking, like, oh, yeah, well, you know, they never said it, but that kid was probably not actually his nephew. He's probably a kidnap victim. But, yeah, no, you're right. Shyamalan would have just come out and said it. At the end of the movie, somebody's talking to the kid, and then there's like a 90-second backstory for this child's kidnapping.
So the two of them are trading messages back and forth, coded messages written in cipher. This becomes important later on. Let's see. The parents are squabbling. We meet a couple other vacation units out and around the resort, one of which is sort of the most obvious type to be stranded on a beach that makes you old, and that's a vapid trophy wife character.
Right.
It's like, okay, that wrote itself.
Yeah.
Didn't even have to slap the tentacle that many times.
No.
On the old...
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there's a button in Final Draft to just generate that character.
Right.
That dialogue.
Yeah, and she's got, she's sort of a Karen to waitstaff when she's being waited on, you know, oh, is this actually calcium rich? I have a calcium deficiency. It gradually emerges that there's something medically wrong with all of these people, not a coincidence, and some of their afflictions are more obvious than others, the most obvious of which is a woman who has a straight-up seizure right in the middle of the buffet room, just collapses. And her husband, who introduces himself as a nurse, his name is Jaron.
Yes.
He has the most puzzling affect of any character in the movie. Occasionally, when he gets worked up, he becomes like a mammal. But most of the time, it's wooden to the point of... It's like mannequin-esque. And I kind of liked that at first, because when his wife hits the deck... He's kind of got this delivery like, it's not his first rodeo.
Right.
You know, oh, she's going to be fine. I've seen this a million times. But it's a very off-putting introduction. And I can't even really do justice to how strange some of his line deliveries are. His character is the most happening of any of these characters. And I don't mean that he's hip and it, with it.
No. Is in 2008's The Happening.
Yes.
No, ma'am, we're not.
No, ma'am, we're not. Mother of God, what kinds of terrorists are these? That line never gets quoted. That's my favorite one. It's when the there's a background character in the bar. They're watching iPhone, like a YouTube video of a zoo attendant walking into the lion enclosure and getting ripped apart. And that's her read on the situation.
Some kind of weird performance art suicide terrorists.
So the guy who runs this vacation getaway comes up to the main family and says, boy, have I got a treat in store for you. But imagine this much more sinister and Scandinavian. He says, there is a special beach. It's secluded. You can't get to it through normal means. There's a rock perimeter that kind of closes it off from the rest of the resort. I can take you there in the morning, special bus. It'll be our little secret. I don't tell this to just anyone, you know. And he
I liked you from the start.
He lays it on real thick. He even describes the beach as being a natural anomaly and then doesn't elaborate on what that means.
And no one's like, I don't know if I want to hang out in an anomaly.
Yeah, right. Like, if you told me, oh, you're going to love this hot spring. It has anomalous properties. I'd be like, what, am I going to grow gills? Is it going to boil me alive? Please extrapolate.
Yeah, no thanks. But we'll just stay here on the regular beach.
Whatever. They're there to have a good time, you know.
Not for a long time.
YOLO. So they meet the movie's most important character the following morning, the aforementioned driver of the bus down to the beach that makes you old. The bus driver is played by, who else? M. Night Shyamalan. He, for whatever reason, loves to cast himself as these bored, listless, just working stiffs who joylessly...
Well, except when Step he's, in. Like, the savior of humanity in Lady in the Water.
I haven't seen Lady in the Water, so that's, like, kind of the fulcrum on which his entire filmography turns, or the spoke, I think, is the analogy I'm striving for. So that's a big blind spot for me. I think I've seen all of his other features. I could be wrong. Anyway, he does the same thing in, oh, what the hell is that movie called? The Village. At the end, he shows up and joylessly delivers an exposition dump about
right.
the nature of the twist, and it's too meta, and he just seems to not be having a good time. He never seems to be having a good time on camera, and sometimes that works. Like, he's Bruce Willis's doctor in Unbreakable,
mm-hmm.
and I like that cameo.
Yeah,
I think that's the only cameo that really does it for me. At least here, it's kind of funny and not as irritating as The Village was. So he, you know, he turns around. It's M. Night. He says, "Everybody got their sunscreen. We've got snacks.
Yeah,
in
bring
the trunk.
A book, towels.
Everyone leave their wallets in their hotel safes.
Don't want to lose them.
Yeah, well, that's pertinent actually. That their IDs are all left behind. So he's in on the scheme. In case you needed to be told that again, it's the same fucking character he played in The Village, basically. So he drives them down to the beach, what makes you old, and they go down to the sand.
The beach, what gives you wrinkles.
And they're doing okay for the most part. There's a few anomalies that start to crop up. Little ones at first, and I actually liked the way that these accumulated fairly swiftly. There's a stranger on the beach, recognized by none of them. We were actually introduced to him in a previous little cutaway. As a black dude and a girl are going for a night swim, skinny dipping. He remains on the beach, watches her. It's exactly like the opening of Jaws. You know, we expect harm to befall this woman, and we're 100% on the money.
It's not true that no one recognizes him, because
oh,
Maddox
yes.
does. Because this guy is apparently a rapper with the stage name Midsize Sedan.
This is so stupid. He did the same. The boy in The Visit wants to be a rapper. Do you remember this? He raps
no.
over the end credits.
I brain bleach. Well,
you completely you're living a marginally more blessed life than I, because it's insufferable. M. Night does not have his finger on the pulse of the hip-hop community. Mid-sized sedan doesn't even register as, like, a joke Wu-Tang kind of name. It's, like, not something you'd get out of a rapper name generator. When she looks at him and says, "That's mid-sized sedan," I thought she was having heat stroke. Like, the joke just flat out.
Honey, that's not a car.
If he'd had a name like Young Hatchback, or something, like I could have lived with Young Hatchback, you know, spelled Y-U-N-G,
sure,
or something like that. But that was totally obnoxious. So
yeah,
it sounded like
a rapper name they would have made up on an episode of the 700 Club.
Right.
Just completely tone deaf, even for joke purposes.
And so I expected this character to be really embarrassing and for me to kind of wind up feeling bad for whatever actor has to portray Young Hatchback. Instead, he started to grow on me. It did not happen right away because he does not make a very strong first impression. He's just hunkered down in the sand, in the shade, by himself. So as I said, all these little anomalies start cropping up, and then a body washes ashore. It bumps into one of the kids, actually, when they're wading. And this is when mid-sized sedan enters the fray, because it's the corpse of the girl that he came to the beach with. And he does not have much to say for himself.
Except, damn.
Damn.
that's like 80% of his dialogue for the first, I don't know, 15, 20 minutes they're on the beach.
And the introduction of his name is so stupid that I figured he would only say damn the whole movie, and it was just going to be a complete
joke.
Yeah,
character.
Exactly. Like a total, I don't know, like
a sub fucking Pokemon
sub Family Guy, like, yeah, gag. But it winds up being slightly more nuanced than that. The reason he's clamming up is because he doesn't want to be implicated. You know, it's the classic I want to talk to my lawyer thing before I put my foot in it. He is worried about taking the fall for this woman's death, perhaps understandably. And one of the
particularly
other guys,
because Rufus Sewell is saying, yeah, this guy fucking did it.
Yes,
obviously.
Yeah, anytime.
Okay, pal.
Anytime you have like a diverse melting pot cast in a high pressure scenario movie like this, whether it's supernatural or not, it doesn't matter. They could all just be trapped in a collapsing subway tunnel or something, waiting for Sylvester Stallone to save them. And one of them would just have to be a racist.
Yeah.
Because, in a different kind of cheesy movie, that would be like a bigotry that they would have to overcome in order to get out of this. We're all in this together, you know, that kind of thing. That's not
Gracias Juan.
Yeah, shout out to Purge Ever After. Here, that's not the case, mercifully. Rufus Sewell only becomes more and more prejudicial as the movie goes on. So yeah, he is really gunning for this guy. He's convinced that he had something to do with the woman's death. And then the shit starts hitting the fan right about now and basically never stops. The movie does move, I'll say that for it. Rufus Sewell's mom, who's the oldest person on the beach, you know, like when they arrive, is not doing so good. Her breathing is irregular. She dies, and then their dog dies, like back to back. And what else? Mid-sized sedan is having chronic nosebleeds. He explains that he has a clotting problem. His blood doesn't clot right. And so his nose is just leaking blood.
Yeah, and the dead girl had, like, MS or something, and that's, you know, they met, I don't, presumably online or something, talking about their problems. And,
or just
and
at the resort, I think.
Whatever it was, I don't know. But either way, they bonded over that. The matriarch of our main family has some kind of tumor. Let's see. Oh, yeah, then there's the calcium deficiency.
Yeah, we deduce that Rufus Sewell has some kind of degenerative brain something or other because he starts cracking.
Yeah, I thought it was
way in advance of all of the other characters psychologically.
I thought it was just some kind of early onset dementia, Alzheimer's thing. Apparently it's some kind of, they call it the bad guys, essentially, call it schizophrenia or like violent schizophrenia or something later. So I guess that's what it's supposed to be.
Yeah, we get the official diagnostic conversation at the tail end of the movie when the villains emerge from the shadows to deliver the standard exposition dumps that come with the territory.
But anyway, we don't notice other than the old woman dying, obviously, we don't notice a lot of aging up front with the adults, but there are three children, and lo and behold, they're growing up. And the first, like, big shift that happens, the main parents do not immediately recognize their two children.
Yeah, right, because they've grown up too rapidly. Let's see, what else? So much happens all at once that it's really not necessary to recount all of it. Some of the smaller but eventually meaningful observations that the characters make is, one, that the water has no fish in it. And then, secondly, there's a bunch of discarded items from previous visitors
rusty
to the beach.
Rusty silverware.
Yeah, rusty silverware and old dolls and, like, children's toys, things like that.
Eventually, they see that the corpse that washed ashore has, like, rotted away completely. It's just bones.
Yes. And this is when they start piecing together, okay, this is the exact exchange rate. Half an hour on the beach is exactly this much anywhere else in the world. They spend a frankly very frustrating amount of time trying to work out exactly how much time they've got left. This is a real bad habit of M. Night Shyamalan's. There are characters in The Happening that do this too. Isn't Mark Wahlberg a math teacher in that movie? Or he's a science teacher.
Yeah.
And he's constantly talking about this or that scientific principle. The characters in this movie, it's nonstop with that kind of stuff. You know, even I rolled my eyes when Gabriel Garcia Bernal reminds someone that he's an actuary.
Right.
Because, oh, of course he's going to bring his expertise to bear now. He says, there's a 99.4% probability that I can't even remember what he's talking about.
Oh, and he's talking about it's a 99.4% chance that someone who has died on vacation has died from, like, not nefarious reasons. He's trying to reassure mid-sized sedan, whose name is apparently Brendan, incidentally, that
yes,
he does not think he's a murderer.
Yeah,
as opposed to Rufus Sewell, who does.
And then when Rufus Sewell's mom croaks and you've got two corpses plus the dog, that's when he says, oh, it's statistically impossible for two people on the same beach to die of unrelated, you know, blah, blah, blah. He's an actuary. You get it.
Yeah.
So on and on and on with that. Rufus Sewell is disintegrating rapidly. Not physically. That's for other characters. He
is really hung up on the movie The Missouri Breaks.
Yes. It's on the tip of his tongue the whole movie. He's got this knife that he keeps fiddling with, and he takes a swipe at Brendan, did you say?
Yes.
Slashes open his cheek. I actually liked this reveal. Brendan turns from the camera, like Phantom of the Opera style, and is like, I must be in shock. I don't feel it anymore. And then turns back, and it's
just
healed up in this kind of Logan-esque way. And that's when, mercifully, they're given irrefutable proof that something supernatural is happening before they have much time to argue about it or naysay about it. So then they start putting their noodles together and trying to figure out a solution, which is admittedly when you get a lot of the really tedious, I'm an actuary, I'm a this, I'm a that. There's also a therapist, right?
The woman with the seizures is a therapist.
And she's constantly trying to get people to open up and join hands in a circle and talk about their feelings. It's all she ever does.
Meanwhile, Jaren, her husband, the nurse, is constantly like, well, you know, this happens for this reason, and this, it's just like, it's not even an exposition dump, it's just like Clippy is up in the corner,
yes,
of the screen just explaining everything that's happening.
Well, it's because all of these people, with a few exceptions, most of this cast is just their careers. I mean, they are just fountains of expertise, of like narrowly defined expertise, and that's all that they jabber on about. There's a beautiful, beautifully ugly line. It reminded me of that line from Haunting of Molly Hartley.
Do you know where my grandmother's a nurse?
Where Jaren says, something is going on with time on this beach. And he says it basically like that. I mean, that was just like a cold read. He says it almost that flatly. Something is going on with time on this beach. Again, it's happening as hell.
Yes.
So things escalate when that benign tumor in the main mother's abdomen grows to the size of a cantaloupe. and they have to cut it out, which is no easy feat because the wounds keep sealing up, so they have to jam their fingers in there and force it open, which is pretty gruesome. And they get the thing out, more gruesome still.
Yeah, and then by the time they get it out, it's like the size of a small watermelon.
And then she's right as rain, somewhat astonishingly.
Yeah.
Speaking of swelling up like a watermelon.
So after the children go through their second growth spurt, Trent and then Rufus Sewell's daughter, who were approximately the same age when they entered the beach, maybe she was a little bit younger, like 6 and 4 or something. They're now teenagers. Maddox had already gotten there the last go-round.
Yeah. So they're off blue lagooning, essentially.
Yes.
Just figuring it out from scratch.
Right.
And they do figure it out, and they walk back into the throng, and she is...
like 4 months pregnant, 4 or 5 months.
Yeah, and then she's 9 months pregnant in the blink of an eye. And then she gives birth. Meanwhile, Jack Nicholson and Marlon Brando made a movie together. I can't... Has anyone seen this film?
This is like the third time he's asked.
He doesn't even
Not even the last time.
He doesn't even clarify that he's thinking of a Western. You
no.
Know, he never says anything else about
There's
it.
Nothing else about the movie except those two people.
I haven't even seen The Missouri Breaks, and I said Missouri Breaks. Like the
But that's because we're robots.
Yes, that's true. Like the automaton
we're
that
just
I am.
IMDb robots. But yeah, the baby dies almost immediately.
And they don't know why at first. It's because it didn't breastfeed for... like basically a half a day, you know, or wasn't swaddled properly. It was not.
It received insufficient attention.
Yes.
Even though it's only been like a minute, because they just decide, yeah, babies change too quickly and require too much attention to be able to survive this environment. And so toast. One thing they discovered a little while back in the thread that we kind of dropped is that they can't get out. They've tried walking back through the slot canyon that they came in through, and every time they reach a certain point, they just get these like big pressure headaches and black out, and then stumble back to the beach and pass out. And when they wake up, they have it explained to them.
And the movie always depicts this as a kind of funny ellipsis followed by a smash cut, where you know it's like a time loop out of one of those wacky. It's like a Happy Death Day kind of a device where it's like you make it a certain number of paces into the ravine.
Well,
particularly
when I think Brendan and Rufus Sewell like both go at the same time, or like Brendan runs off and then Rufus Sewell's like, no, the black man's getting away. And so he chases after him. And then, you know, the cut to black and smash cut to them both passed out like next to each other on the beach.
Looking groggy and kind of hungover, and the nurse hypothesizes, again, bringing his fucking expertise to bear, that it's like getting the bends when you try to resurface too quickly. So they can't make it off the beach because their cells are being affected. Oh, well, then why aren't our hair and nails growing, you know, commensurately with the
because
rest
those
of the...
cells are dead. We didn't... Did you write this for CinemaSins?
Right,
I mean,
exactly.
Like, I did not need to know
and
that.
And I have even more problems with that I'm going to tackle after the intermission.
Especially considering that there are so many other things in this movie that if you wanted to go all CinemaSins on them, you could have a fucking field day.
Well,
why bother getting hung up on that?
Exactly. You shouldn't even try to make this premise nitpick proof because it can't be. It's a Swiss cheese. It's like there's always going to be something to pick apart because it's so timey-wimey, you know, that there's just no way to do something like this in a way that's going to be completely bulletproof from that kind of bad faith criticism. So why bother?
Right. Like, why is the silverware rusty if it's
yes.
only living cells that are affected?
Yeah, silverware is needless to say, inanimate. Every bit as inanimate as hair or fingernails. It's just I think this movie would have frankly been a true blue horror flick if their nails and hair.
Oh my god, cut it again!
They were just constantly filing and Rapunzeling all over the place. Christ, that would be really something to behold.
It's heinous.
So Rufus Sewell goes berserk. This is the one thing I haven't explained at all what I like about this Brendan fellow. He's just a little bit more nuanced than you'd expect given his introduction, but then any amount of nuance would be more than you expect given his introduction. I like his like self-preservation instincts vis-a-vis the corpse on the beach and how he's genuinely shaken by it, but doesn't trust any of these people. And that's played pretty well by the actor. And then his death is stupid and shitty. He dies off screen. He's knifed to death a dozen times over by Rufus Sewell, who
crucially stabs him in quick enough succession that he cannot heal between blows,
and in enough,
I guess.
Enough vital organs, I guess. Because most of the blows that we see heal up, like Wolverine style, are glancing, relatively superficial cuts. Other than the surgery, yeah. So he's dead. No amount of clotting would have helped him bounce back from that one. The grieving mother, the girl who was four and now is carrying a dead baby everywhere she goes, she tries to scale the cliff to escape off the beach. The nurse tries to go into the water and swim for it. His corpse winds up washing ashore. I think the implication there is that he hits a similar barrier
and blacks out and drowns.
Yeah, to what they're encountering when they try to go through the canyon.
Yeah, because the girl like blacks out near the top of the cliff and then falls to her death.
Yes.
Her mother, the one with the calcium deficiency, wanders off for a long stretch, eventually returning as a hunchback. Apparently this is a side effect of the calcium deficiency.
Yeah, it's pretty... I like the reveal of her degeneracy because there's always so much shit going on in this movie. It's part of its appeal. It cuts to her in the midst of some other calamity. She is walking around kind of in a stupor, and she's got this tie-dye shawl over herself, but you can just tell that her shape isn't quite right, and she's wailing. She's like a tie-dye La Llorona all of a sudden. You know, like, where's my daughter? What happened? And, you know, her mascara is running down her face.
Well, obviously, not to mention she's looking kind of leathery because she's very much a tan, you know, beach lady. And then you slap on 20, 25 years and that's how that shit goes.
And, you know, the fact that she's, as I said before, the vapid trophy wife, obviously the thing to do with her is make her go mad because she is no longer pretty. That's the most hack thing you could possibly do. However, the way it's executed, I kind of liked. And more to come. What else? The main couple, Gabriel Garcia Bernal and his wife, who's the actress from Phantom Thread, whose name escapes me.
Vicky Creeps?
Yes, I think that's right. I know that's right. The two of them, he's going blind. She's going deaf. She's already deaf in one ear. So the two of them are having a hard time communicating. And that's kind of touching. They turn into like a doddering old married couple right before our eyes in the span of 30 minutes or so from here till the end of the movie.
Yeah.
So in the midst of their descent into doddering old married couple, Rufus Sewell becomes completely mad and starts coming down the beach towards them. He can barely see him. She straight up can't hear him. So... Neither of them realize they're in danger.
Yeah, she's looking in the other direction, and her husband is trying to get her attention and ask her who is scuttling towards them. Because that's what Rufus Sewell is doing.
Yes.
He's scuttling on the ground like some kind of Samara type.
So he starts rambling nonsensically about what else? His career.
His career.
and his credentials.
And, you know,
I'm a doctor.
That man was going to steal things from our home.
Yes.
That's why I had to do what I did.
Yeah, mid-sized sedan. So he's landing a bunch of, again, glancing blows on the guy's arms and face, and the wife runs off to get the kids to safety. They take refuge in a tunnel on the beach where they encounter the tie-dye La Llorona, who's become even more of a,
don't look at me, oh!
And she... is they keep lighting matches, which she doesn't like. She turns up into just like an SCP, practically. It's like, oh, the SCP-00 whatever doesn't like being looked at. She just turns into a straight-up monster. It reminded me very much of Zelda in Pet Sematary, the sister with spinal meningitis.
Yeah.
Because she starts crawling towards them and tries to wedge herself through this tight part of the tunnel, and her bones...
It's not the part of the tunnel is not even tight. She's not breaking her bones because she's trying to squeeze through a tight space. She breaks her bones by thrashing around.
Well, and she drops a boulder on herself at one point. That's how it starts.
She's going to throw a boulder at them. And then she, like, loses her grip on it, or maybe her arm just breaks from the weight, and then it rapidly heals in an awful position.
And we could have inferred that, but, of course, the...
Maddox explains it to us.
Yeah, says as much in those exact words.
Although, I honestly didn't mind that particular line of dialogue.
Well, I wouldn't have known right away that it had healed in the wrong position, but then when she starts thrashing and, like, completely pretzels herself, I would have gone, like, oh, no, her bones are... whatever. I would have caught up. It's annoying because it's juxtaposed with a different gruesome kill, which is Vicky Creeps comes back and slashes at Rufus Sewell with one of the rusty knives, which she's retrieved from the sand. And so then he gets rapid blood poisoning that spreads all through his skin.
Aggressive tetanus.
And she explains what's happening to him as though he could even understand. I mean, he was a doctor decades ago. So maybe he gets it. But all the more reason for her to not have to explain it. I mean, I feel like even earlier in the movie when the kids say, hey, Mom, there's some rusty silverware over there, she even says, oh, don't touch it. You could cut yourself and get infected. If she just had a line there to do with, like, oh, blood poisoning can be a big deal. You know, that's serious. I don't want you mucking around with that stuff. That would have been more than enough. So that's the main reason that the, oh, no, her bones are healing in the wrong position thing bothered me, is because then it cuts to an equally unnecessary bit of expository dialogue to do with the other gruesome murder that are running on parallel tracks here. And I overall liked this sequence. Those two lines are, I think, totally disposable. So both of the antagonists, such as they are no more. We're now left with just the four that we started with.
Family. Did we mention that the therapist eventually just has a cascade of seizures?
Yes, and that was a long time coming. That kind of threw me. I thought, like, surely she should have been the first to go. This actually winds up being retroactively clever, and more on that shortly. Yes, she seizes and dies, foaming at the mouth, shortly after her husband goes into the surf, never to return. So, Gabriel Garcia Bernal dies after having some sort of touching deathbed dialogue with his wife, and they look, you know, ancient at this point. And then,
well, they really don't look that ancient. I mean, they look older.
I mean, it's not like Rose at the end of Titanic, but, you know.
Well, they don't even, they're not even like gray particularly. They look like they could be late 50s, early 60s tops.
No, you're right. I think, and this is another, I guess, CinemaSins tack to take. They have, to be fair, been in the hot sun for decades. Like, maybe they should look much worse than they do. I mean, they should all have skin cancer.
They should look older and then leatherier.
Yeah, right.
But whatever. Yeah, so he dies, and then, like, 30 seconds later, his wife dies.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids are left alone on the beach.
So the following day, the two kids are having a midlife crisis. And they start making sandcastles together, and they have some dialogue to do with, oh, you know, what it's like to be an adult and a child at the same time. Do you think all adults feel this way? And then, reminiscing about childhood, the guy remembers, oh, yeah, I never translated the last cipher that kid at the resort gave me. I'm going to go do that. He does. And I was bracing myself for something completely brain dead here, because
just
you can,
like,
see,
don't go to beach.
You can see the twist being deployed. You know, it's like a airplane touching down on the tarmac. Like, oh, here it comes.
Reaching for the parachute.
You can hear the roar of the jet engines of this twist being unfurled as he hacks this code. And he looks at it and it says, my uncle doesn't like the coral. And there was one throwaway line earlier, like, oh, kids, look at the coral reef. Look how pretty. Something like that. And then it never gets touched on again because they've got other shit on their plate. So they think, okay, maybe we can use, maybe the coral shields you from whatever weird radiation is causing all of this. Maybe if we can get through the coral reef, we can make it out into the open ocean to safety. So they go out to test that theory. She gets snagged on a jagged piece of coral. And it looks like they're both done for. They're going to drown. It cuts to who else? your boy M. Night Shyamalan up on a ridge. All through the movie, they've been seeing these little twinkling lights up on the cliff top. And at first, you're thinking, is this aliens? Is this spirits of some kind? What's going on?
Is it some kind of aging laser?
Turns out it's just the glint of a camera. He's just been sort of documenting them this whole time.
He's been surveilling them, yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly. And so he packs up his rig, talks to his boss on the phone. Again, very The Village. And trial 73 complete. I'll collect my things and bring the data back to you, sir. And then he comes back to home base, and there's all these big pharma creeps looking over the data and congratulating themselves for another successful trial.
Yeah,
and
it's just a big pharmaceutical multi-purpose trial. It's like, it's useful because we can track changes over time in a short time.
And they're thrilled. Ooh. They're thrilled because the anti-seizure medication that they slipped into the one woman's drink forestalled her seizures for several hours on the beach, which amounts to several decades.
Yeah, or like 16 years, I think, is the figure they use.
Basically, as far as they're concerned, cured her epilepsy. So now they're going to cure a lot of people and also be extremely wealthy.
Right.
Because they figured out a cure for epilepsy. It's a little asinine because you can only test one drug per person per trial. You know, it's not like it's replicable.
No.
So it's, I'm sure they have a lot of duds. Then, you know, it looks like they're going to get away with it. But hey, what's this? Both of the kids, no longer kids, make it back to the resort and blow the whistle on them. And the movie...
Because one of the people, incidentally, that Trent, as a six-year-old, is interrogating about their occupations is like, oh, I'm a cop. And
that must be what it's like to meet M. Night Shyamalan at a party. You know, he just wants to know
what is your name and what do you do?
Who
is
your daddy?
Okay, nice to meet you.
Who is your daddy and what does he do?
Bye now.
That's all there is to these people. Anyway, he gives him a book that they found, a journal that they found on the beach where a previous victim had very...
Not before saying, you're a cop, off screen. Like, we see
his gruff, middle-aged man voice.
The guy's like, who the hell are you?
Yeah. So he gives him this journal that they found. A previous victim had logged the names and addresses of everyone in his trial. So the cop puts out some feelers, finds out these are all missing persons cases, and then justice comes swiftly for the proprietors of this sinister resort.
And there's like a slow-mo tracking shot where we're seeing all the people kind of experiencing the end of this resort happening, and we see the cop like walking with the journal and walking off screen.
Pan up to the sky, dramatic cut to black, roll credits?
No. Then we get to see how the brother and sister survived, which is just that they broke free and swam to where they could breathe. There was no secret. There was no special thing they did.
Yeah, I thought that for sure that there was going to be something mystical about the coral.
Well, and then it looked like he was going to go in that direction because, like, they're yanking on a piece of coral and then, like, this weird CGI crack appears into it.
That was stupid. I had no idea what to make of that.
I thought it was just going to, like, open wide and swallow them up and then spit them out. No. They just got free and then swam to air.
Well, because let's do justice to this, to the mise-en-scene here of this coral tunnel. I actually do like the way it looks, and I haven't liked the look of any of M. Night's movies in several years. It's fairly imposing. It's a tunnel that's ringed with coral on all sides. It looks like a sarlacc pit.
Right.
So had the coral started gnashing like teeth and like chewed them up, it wouldn't have been that... I mean, no, it would have been totally out of left field. But it looks like that could maybe happen. So that, yeah, when that weird rift opened up, that was totally unasked for. I don't know what he was driving at there. I'm okay-ish with this epilogue because the shot of them making it out of the tunnel and then, oh my god, there's fish, we're free, that works as like a happy note to go out on. It's more visually striking and more kind of triumphant than just the slow-mo shots of the villains doing the perp walk or whatever. Then there's another epilogue, which I totally detested.
Yeah, it cuts to black again.
Yes.
And then it's just them in a chopper with the cop taking a long distance tour of the beach. I half expected them to like fly crash too close and get stuck. They didn't.
Yeah, like they veer too close and the pilot's like, oh no, my asthma is getting dramatically worse at an accelerated rate.
And I'm passing out because I'm getting time bends.
I'm too close to the beach. That makes you old. We're going down.
That would have been completely fucking brain dead, but at least that would have been like an ending sting or something that would have justified this scene's existence. But anyway, it's like, no, they just say, yeah, okay, well, you know, we've put out subpoenas and then we're going to get them all. Okay, let's get them to the airport. Fucking roll credits. Like, what?
Yeah, basically all that this epilogue serves to do is clarify where the kids who are no longer kids are going next. They're going to their aunt's place, apparently. And it just establishes that the villains are definitely going to get in trouble for all this because it was maybe ambiguous before. I didn't think it was that ambiguous. So that's the note that we end on. It's a weak note to go out on, but we'll have more to say for good and ill after the break.
What's happening to us?
My daughter just turned 6 2 weeks ago.
Mom?
Whatever's happening to us is happening very fast.
You have wrinkles. There's something wrong with this beach.
What's happening?
Mom! 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 I'm scared!
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at Shock Doctors Pod, on Facebook at facebook.com/shockdoctorspod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
We have to get off this beach!
People are blacking out going this way.
If she makes it to the ledge, she might have a chance.
Why is she stopping?
Why is she stopping? Kara, wake up!
Wake up!
They have to know what this place does.
I don't know!
You're lying!
Look!
What is that?
A message.
We never leave each other. Nothing separates us.
We're connected to something bigger.
Oh no. We're here for a reason.
And we're back. So, it sounds like Matt liked certain things about this movie. I think as far as I'm concerned, I really didn't like it at all.
I'm going to say something that might surprise you. It's my favorite M. Night Shyamalan movie since Signs.
Wow.
I liked it more than a little bit. I didn't like it a lot, but I liked it way more than I expected to.
Better than Split?
Yes.
Yeah, no, I can't. I'm not going to say
well, thank
this
you
right.
Thank you for doing just a couple seconds of soul searching there. That means a lot to me.
You know, I'm trying to give you the benefit of the doubt.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going to say this rises to the level of The Turning and our dispute thereon. But I think fundamentally you're out of your gourd. But go on.
Well, no, I mean, it has a shitload of problems. I mean, there are some small mercies to be found. Like, right when the movie opened, we were both, like, groaning audibly about baby Trent and his awful dialogue. He sounds like, it's like the kind of precocious child who's, like, too annoying even for a bad movie. It's like something from a bad TV commercial.
Yeah.
It's like the kind of kid who's like, oh, mom and dad always buy such and such grape juice. Don't they know that Welsh's grape juice has all these nutrients and, you know, that kind of thing? like, oh, my God. It's agony. And I think, looking back, Haley Joel Osment, I mean, his turn in Sixth Sense is already one of the most lauded child actor performances in history, but he deserves even more credit than he got because almost all of M. Night's movies feature kids prominently. He loves writing kids. He's never written them particularly well. And the one good child actor performance, it's a great one, is Haley Joel Osment in Sixth Sense, at least where his filmography is concerned, because most of his children are completely impossible to put up with. However, given that this movie is what it is, you don't have to put up with them for very long. They don't remain kids for more than just the first act or so. And the dialogue can be very The Happening at times. However, given the nature of the peril here, I mean, some of the nurses' line deliveries were just totally woeful in a way that I can't make allowances for. But everybody else pretty much sells it, I think. Rufus Sewell, I genuinely liked. And everyone else is varying shades of okay. And I think the fact that they talk kind of incoherently and unnaturally, it just feels like a side effect of what's happening to them. When we reviewed The Lodge, is that what it's called?
Yeah.
I talked about how there were stretches in that movie that made me feel like there was a gas leak in the movie theater.
Right.
Because what you think is happening in that movie is that there was a gas leak in the cabin that killed them, and now their restless spirits are haunting the place, and they don't know that they're dead, and that's why they're experiencing time in an unnatural fashion, because the house is still full of gas and they've been kind of unmoored from life and from reality. And I really like when a movie can dip into that headspace. Old is no The Lodge, but it is, I think, a prime example of gas leak cinema. The dialogue exchanges did feel unreal in that way, and where that's always been to Shyamalan's detriment, to the detriment of his films, this was the one time I can remember thinking that it was actually an asset. Some of the time, not all of the time. Yeah, I would say even more than half of the time. I don't want to undersell it. I think I was pretty much won over by this movie by the end, dumbass epilogue notwithstanding.
I don't know how much credit I can give the man for writing himself into positions where he covers up problems of his own creation. Okay, so you can't write kids for shit. I don't know, write them better.
I agree with you.
And
I don't think he's even deliberately patching up. I think he's still, even after all the critical drubbings he's taken, I think he probably still has too much of an ego to even recognize that these are problems, or he would just try to write kids differently. I think that he lucked into it, that these problems are not as pronounced as they would ordinarily be.
And I don't know how persuaded I am by your "this is a side effect" theory. I mean, there's nothing I could say particularly that can, you know, disprove what you're saying. Fundamentally, it's a matter of opinion. I don't know that I buy it.
No, I don't necessarily. Again, authorial intent is often not worth speculating on. I do think that he lucked into it to a certain extent this time out. Some of the strengths or some of the weaknesses that have maybe contextually become strengths, your mileage may vary. Now, there are other problems of his, long-running problems that he has not fixed, like how everyone spends half the movie crunching the numbers and talking about their careers. That's as annoying as it's ever been. I've used the words annoying, irritating, obnoxious over and over again in this review. It's the most you'll ever hear those words in a positive review in your entire life, most likely. But it reminded me of John Leguizamo, I think, is who I'm thinking of in The Happening. His death. They're in a car. They're speeding away from, you know, the evil wind that's killing everyone in The Happening. It's the most immaterial villain in movie history. And there's some kids in the car, because of course there are, and he's trying to keep the kids calm. No, yeah, he's, I think, a math professor, and he's a co-workers of Marky Mark's. Marky Mark does the science, John Leguizamo does the math, and so he's doing math problems to keep the kids diverted, and he's asking, like, if you had, I don't remember what it is, if you had two cats and one
of them got on a train going 55 miles an hour in this direction.
Well, it's about, is it factorials where you multiply something exponentially, like 2, 4, 8, 16, you know, and you get to like a trillion faster than you'd think you would?
Those are not factorials.
Okay,
no.
Well, then I don't know what I forgot the word exponent earlier today. This is not my forte. Jim can attest to that. In any case, it's something to do with him crunching the numbers, and then he looks up and there's a hole in the roof and the evil wind has gotten into the car. And right before they suicide, because that's what the evil wind makes you do in The Happening, he goes, like, you would have 457,000 million cats or something like that.
Right.
And then the car crashes into a tree and explodes or whatever the hell. It's the only way that he knows how to write adult characters, and his kid characters are even worse, admittedly, but he doesn't really write fully realized adults for the most part either. They really are just mostly what they do for a living. Now, the exception to this is I did find the relationship towards the end in their rapid onset senescence fairly touching with Vicky Creeps and Gael Garcia Bernal. I think that some of the writing between them is better than M. Night's usual batting average. They have a half blind, half deaf heart to heart about not even an affair that she had, which would have, if it had been an honest to God affair, that would have felt kind of contrived. Mm-hmm. Instead, it's just like flirty texts that she's been getting from this guy, and he saw them on her phone once and he didn't say anything about it, and he thinks if she was going to cheat on him, she could do better because
he's a pretend person,
which is a nice turn of phrase. And I don't know, I mean, that made me laugh, and I can't remember the last time. I mean, so many, in addition to just their artistic and technical failings, M. Night's movies are so often
dire
and dirge-like. Like, I don't like Unbreakable as much as a lot of people because it is such a fucking funeral. You know, it's like it's got a good look to it and a good mood. It's almost like aquatic. It's so dark. It's like it's got this subterranean gloom to it, the whole thing. But I think the twist at the end is pretty silly, and it's just too depressed all the way through. And I normally go in for that sort of thing, but it's just a little too one note, a little thin, I think. Where am I going with this? But it was a good looking movie, and his movies lately have not been good looking. I thought Glass was really visually uninspired, and I harped on about that when we reviewed it.
Yes.
This movie is not like that much to look at. In fact, there's stuff to do with the framing that really bothered me. A lot of shots are composed really weirdly, where there'll just be...
Let me get into this.
Yeah, beat me to the punch here. Head me off at the pass.
So the framing and the camera movement.
Yes.
Is just a train wreck. I mean, so often... Okay, so early on when they're at the beach, it serves a purpose, and I can more or less accept it, although he drags it out too long for my taste. But, like, so often, people are, like, barely in frame.
Yeah, there'll be an awkward amount of their anatomy in the frame. When they're taking the tumor out of What's-Her-Name, you see just the top of the therapist's scalp and then the nurse's right eye. And other than that, it's just empty blue sky.
Yeah. And the part that I'm alluding to where it makes sense is we're seeing, like, the kid's eye or, you know, whatever.
It's
or
just
their,
an ear.
Hand,
yeah, an
and,
ear
you know,
and then, like, some out-of-focus faces in the background because like he's trying to ally to the fact that they've grown up.
Yeah. And that, okay, that's fine. But again, drags it out too long. But yeah, it's just, like, people are positioned weirdly in frame. The frame is just placed somewhere that doesn't make sense in so many of the shots.
He does a lot of weird pans, like 360 pans. That
yes.
Are...
The camera movement is much more irritating than the framing. He does 360 pans. That's one thing. He does a lot of, like, I think where it reached its zenith of stupidity, so it's nadir of quality, if you will, is when the girl, Rufus Sewell's daughter, is climbing the cliff, trying to get over it. He keeps, like, swooping down on the people watching from below, but not in a way that's, like, conveying the height that she's ascended to. It's just, mm-hmm. like, if the camera starts from, like, 5 feet above them and then kind of swivels down to 3 feet above them.
And the staging is weird because it's zooming in on the kid from Hereditary, who's Trent, right?
Yes, yes, teenage Trent.
And it's like Shyamalan is filming a live sporting event because he, like, zooms in right as the actor lunges forward. So he's, like, shouting, but, like, Shyamalan misses his face and then, like, has to catch up to him. It's really sloppy, and the rest of the movie is not shot like that. So it doesn't read as, like, a stylistic choice. It's just a weird flub that got left in. I can make allowances for some of the weird camera work because for me it did contribute to that dizzy, disoriented feeling, but it was a bit much and often executed in a kind of sloppy, haphazard manner.
Yeah,
and
mean
that shot bothered me more than probably any of the others.
Yeah, I buy the argument that you make the camera work a little bit weird to kind of Dutch angle your perceptions, if you will, but yeah, I mean, so much of it just felt unmotivated. It's just completely at random a lot of the time, and it just looked kind of silly.
Well, and I felt like a goofy kind of charitability welling up in my soul. Very uncharacteristic feeling for me. It's like the end of The Grinch towards the end of this movie. And I was like, oh my God, buddy, that's like your fourth 360 degree pan. You gotta get a new trick out of your box of tricks. But I was like having fun with the stupidity of it, which is not a feeling I ever had watching The Happening. I mean, The Happening is just kind of, it's got some standout moments, but if you've seen like the super cut of like the so bad it's good parts of The Happening, it's like the Nick Cage Wicker Man. Do you actually want to sit down and watch the whole thing? Probably not. You probably just want to watch the 11-minute YouTube montage.
No, you should watch the whole movie. It's a good time.
I stand corrected.
It's
You're talking about The Happening or The Wicker Man?
Oh, The Wicker Man.
Okay, just to be clear.
Not The Happening.
Okay.
Yeah, no, the crux of your point is legit. You just compared it to the wrong film.
Well, I'll watch any movie start to finish because I'm a robot.
Well, that too.
As we've discussed, but I'm talking about a normal person.
The thing that the overactive camera movement reminded me of, I went to see Ready Player One with my buddy Michael and our friend Kevin, and none of us liked it, incidentally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I didn't much care for it either.
It's really not very good, which you had to kind of expect when Spielberg is making a movie out of Spielberg fanfic. It's a snake eating its own tail. It's a terrible idea. But the thing that I remember Michael complaining about is that Spielberg already has a fondness, and some might even call it a weakness sometimes, for like big, swoopy, moving the camera around, like, look at how active this is. And giving him, like, CGI license to do that at will as much as he fucking wants was a bad idea. That didn't, like, stand out to me about that movie, but I saw what he meant when he said it. And that's, like, one of the first things I thought of once M. Night started going off the rails with the camera movement in this movie. That.
Undisciplined, I think, is the word I would use in both cases.
Yes,
Unmotivated. Unmotivated would be another word for it. Having said all that, there are shots in this movie that I was rather taken with. I mean, there's plenty to get exercised about in a bad way, but there was, I don't know, there's a shot of lapping waves. They're all standing on the beach, and the water is in the foreground. It's like a shot straight out of Jaws, where the water is at eye level with the camera, basically. Mm-hmm. And so the water is kind of lapping against. But it's not like one of those things where you get actual moisture on the lens, like drops forming, which always kind of take me out of the movie. I mean, I'm sure I've seen good movies that did that, but that's always like a minor, like a micro interruption to my experience of watching a movie.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of Spielberg, I think that happens on Omaha Beach.
Yeah. Well, there I can live with it, because that D-Day landing sequence is striving for a documentary feel.
Sure.
But unless you're striving for that, it's probably bad to remind me of the machinery involved here, lenses,
or if it's
on.
Not water, it's blood spatter,
right?
You know? Yeah, I know what you mean.
Here, it's not that in your face, but the water gets just high enough in the frame to where it's just like a blue haze almost at the bottom of the frame, and I found that kind of oppressive and ominous. It reminded me of, there's a shot in The Master. It's the first time that Philip Seymour Hoffman and Joaquin Phoenix share a bunch of time on screen together. It's like after they've found him stowed away on his boat. And every time it cuts back to Joaquin Phoenix, Philip Seymour Hoffman is wearing this red bathrobe or like smoking jacket or something, like bright red. And it'll cut back to Joaquin Phoenix, and there'll just be a little thin, fuzzy strip of red on the very edge of the frame. So you get this feeling of like, Philip Seymour Hoffman, you get his presence in both of the shots. But when it cuts to The Master, it's just The Master. But when it cuts to Joaquin Phoenix, it's both of them, even though The Master's presence is very understated. And that kind of tells you a lot about the nature of the power dynamic in this cult. Right off the bat, I thought that was very clever. And the way that the waves were depicted in that shot specifically reminded me of that, the fuzziness of it and the level of restraint, you know, not letting the waves actually lap against the camera, but just showing the bare minimum to where you get that almost like blue halo. It's hard for me to describe visually, but I thought that was rather arresting. It's all set in daylight for the most part, which I think is a neat trick when it comes to horror. You know, this movie's no Midsommar, but
yeah, I get what you're saying.
I don't know, I already talked about the shot I like with the fish, them being swarmed by the fish once they make it to safety was enough to justify that epilogue's existence for me. I like the look of the coral tunnel. It's a low bar, admittedly. Glass, for me, set the bar very, very low visually. And so I may be damning with faint praise here, but the movie does not look bad. Wonky camera work and framing notwithstanding. Also had to say notwithstanding many times in this review.
Yes.
Which is, make of that what you will.
Yeah, I can't say I noticed the blue halo, blue fringe effect you did.
I waxed poetic about that shot for probably longer than it deserved. But that was take that as a stand-in for, you know, maybe a half dozen to a dozen other shots that I liked but can't remember with enough specificity to actually talk about them.
The only stuff that I particularly liked visually was with the hunchbacked X model in the cave.
Yes, I liked that too, until she pretzeled like one too many times, and then it just got...
Yeah, okay, when in the last one or two cuts back to her, it does look a little silly. But, you know, it's just got a very gothic, very, I don't know, Shutter Island sort of look to it, and when she just breaks her arm the first time, that's like, ooh, it works. That was really the only thing I particularly cared for looking at.
Yeah, they missed a trick there, not having them... We don't see them actually make it out of the tunnel. I would have liked a little sequence where they make their way out and her body has already begun rapidly decomposing. Just like one more, because again, this scene plays out in total darkness, save for the occasional match being struck. I could have done with one more match strike that shows her slightly desiccated, maybe like vacant eye sockets or something like that. So something to sort of put a bow on that whole sequence. I thought a shot like that was a total no-brainer, and for some reason it was missing.
Yeah.
Not like a Shyamalan to not go for a low-hanging fruit like that.
Right. I guess the last thing I want to touch on briefly before we get to recommendations is that, I mean, the trope of Shyamalan movies being about the twist is old as the hills, but at the same time, after a certain point, you want it to be there. You know, you want something wacky to hang your hat on. Even if it doesn't work, it's still memorable. It's still something you can talk about. And they don't all have to be Bruce Willis is dead too, anything like that. They can be dumb as all get out. They could be the ending of The Village, for example. And that's at least fodder for conversation. But the way this movie ends is just such a wet fart. It's not like these people all washed up on a desert island and suffered these effects, and then the fact that they were brought there was due to human agency or anything like that. We know up front that they were taken there, and then they observed these lights, and we see M. Night at the end, like, packing up his cameras and shit, although Maddox at one point concludes, like, oh, those are cameras.
Yeah, at roughly the two-thirds point, I'd say, in the movie.
And, okay, so, you know, what's the big reveal here? The reason they're... so they're not just, like...
Doing it for kicks.
Doing it for shits and... we're not, like, watching some weird supernatural escape room Minos thing going on.
Thank God.
They have at least some positive motive. Okay, whatever.
It is.
I don't give a shit.
It's a half twist at best. It's fairly weak. Although I read it as, I mean, yeah, definitely. As soon as the sinister Swede uses the term natural anomaly, we know who's behind this. We just, as you said, we don't know why they're doing it. So then we find out why, and it isn't a full blown twist, and it is anticlimactic, but I was a little bit charitably disposed to it because, to me, it played as a stronger version, or like a less risible version, of the twist in Glass, where you find out the powers that be that have been, like with the wrist tats. Do you remember this? Like one of them.
Oh, yeah.
The sniper. And it turns out that there's this shadowy cabal that's been trying to prevent the general populace from finding out that there are superheroes in their midst. You know, they don't want us to realize our potential or else we'll rise up and whatever. It's all kind of a weird preachy treatise about superhero movies, I think, or comic books or who knows what the hell. That movie had ideas. They were all just very muddled, I thought. This movie, it's basically the same thing. It's the powers that be, only there is a little bit more kind of perfunctory gray area with the like, oh, we're going to heal millions of people. I was already kind of it's like the psychiatrist coming in at the end of Psycho. You're already kind of mentally walking out into the lobby, even if your ass hasn't left the seat yet. That's about the nicest thing I could say about it. And obviously this goes without saying, old is no Psycho.
Right.
Old is no Midsommar. Old is not on par with any of the movies that I've likened it to in this review. But yeah, the weakness of the twist, so-called, didn't bother me all that much. The Village I watched when I was like 13 or 14, and I predicted at the very beginning, okay, either the twist is going to be that the town elders are dressing up like these monsters and it's a conspiracy, or somehow this is all going to be set in the present day. And then it turned out it was both. I was like, okay, fuck you. So I am not longing for the halcyon days of Village style twists. I do think we talked about this before we even went in to see the movie. His twists have been pretty weak sauce lately. I mean, the twist in The Visit makes sense and is fine, but you kind of see it coming a mile away. There's nothing supernatural about it. It just sort of arrives. This movie is, I think, comparable to that twist in its inoffensiveness, I think, is the word I would use. I mean, it didn't bother me, but it also didn't make me feel anything.
Well, yeah, but at least in The Visit, the twist has an impact on the characters.
Okay.
I think I
take your drift.
Yeah, it's equally unsurprising for us, but you do get, like, there is some dramatic irony at work there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the kids figure out, spoilers for The Visit, these aren't their grandparents eventually. And while you're waiting for that shoe to drop on them, and then while you're watching them come to grips with that, there's a little zhuzh there. There's a little something there. Here, it's just a complete fucking wet fart. It's just nothing.
I will say, on the subject of The Visit, I like old leaps and bounds more than that movie, in part because, well, first of all, I think The Visit, it has a couple good scares in it, decent scares, but it is basically Shyamalan doing found footage schlock, like kind of dime a dozen found footage movies like that. You know, the ending of Deborah Logan is dreadful, but on the whole, Deborah Logan is just a better version of The Visit, where you're afraid of Granny, basically, because she's going crazy.
Right.
Or she's possessed, one or the other. In The Visit, it's a fear of the elderly that he's playing into, whereas in old, it's a fear of aging. And I find that just 10 times more relatable as a person who's newly 30. Well, not that newly in the grand scheme of things, as years flying by. Years begin to do that the older you get, because when you're 10 years old, 1 year is 10% of your life up till that point. So it's a truism that time flies the older you get, but it is, I mean, there's some psychological truth to it, because a year is a smaller pie slice the older you get.
Yes.
And I think that's a very, you know, the frailty of the flesh, all that body horror stuff, I think old plays to that relatively well. I liked the hearing loss. I liked the incipient blindness. It's, I think, I don't know, it's scary to feel like your body is betraying you. I got more wrapped up in that, let's just say, than the idea of senility being this sanity-devouring boogeyman that turns you into a psycho monster, which is sort of the way that it's depicted in The Visit, except for in the case of Rufus Sewell, whose sanity is devoured and he does turn into a psycho rage monster or whatever I just said.
Right.
But, you know, movies like this need something in the way of a primary antagonist who poses some kind of physical threat. In an immediate sense, not just Minos or whoever off in the distance on the hilltop with their camera lenses glinting.
So I guess
other than Midsommar, which we reviewed, that's also a prime example of gas leak cinema. I mean, the tripping sequences in Midsommar
sure.
are a better version of the kind of ambiance that I wound up liking in Old. A kind of more, I don't know, artistically defensible version.
Well, yeah,
of
and
the
then
same,
you know,
of the same vibe
in that movie. I mean, I've never taken hallucinogens myself. I have been around people when they have, and the way the characters in Midsommar talk to each other while they're whacked out feels natural and genuine in a way that this does not. It still feels like they're a bunch of aliens talking to one another.
Yes.
And
no,
trying to pretend to be human.
I don't disagree. And like I think Rufus Sewell brings it off admirably, and everyone else struggles to varying degrees, but for me succeeds, with the exception of the poor nurse who is happening as all get out.
Yes.
But other than Midsommar, what I would recommend is a movie that I dearly, dearly love called Picnic at Hanging Rock, early Peter Weir film, Australian classic, about a picnic in the year 1900. The movie is framed like a true story. It's not, but watching the movie, you buy into the unsolved mysteries kind of air that it generates. I mean, it's like a classy costume drama version of like an episode of Cold Case Files. It makes my kind of hair stand up the same way that like true crime television does. It very capably taps into that like unsolved mystery kind of feeling, like all these people were actually spirited away. So what happens on this fateful Valentine's Day picnic in the year 1900 is these girls from this girls' boarding school, they start to scale Hanging Rock, which is an actual edifice, an actual rock formation in Australia, which has various legends associated with it, and they all vanish off the face of the earth. And what ensues is an investigation which is wholly inconclusive, and there are suspects. Is it a murder? Kidnapping? Did they run away? Is it UFOs? What the fuck is it? It's a totally eldritch, totally unknowable. It's like one of the most like deeply unnerving mystery movies I've ever seen, because it's just a perfect mess of contradictions. Like, well, it couldn't have been plausible explanation why, because look at this that refutes that. It couldn't be plausible explanation X. It couldn't be suspect A because of this. It couldn't be. It's a, you know, you could drive yourself crazy trying to untie that Gordian knot. It was designed to be insoluble, and that's what I like about it. So as long as you go in not expecting a tidy resolution, but rather a creepy, lingering feeling of unease, like what you would get from an unsolved mystery episode that never got an update. You know, Robert Stack, update, you know, like, oh, that's always, I always get such catharsis from that. No updates here. Never caught the guy. Never found out what the hell happened. And therein lies the pleasure of it, at least for me. You don't get, certainly, heaps of exposition the way you would in a Shyamalan joint. It just is what it is. Hanging Rock keeps its secrets when the credits roll. I'll put it that way.
The movie I'm going to recommend is something, I don't remember exactly when we watched it. We did watch it, and I think it's been inside the life of the podcast, but we definitely didn't do an episode. The movie's called Sweetheart.
I've seen that. I don't think we watched that. No, we did watch that together. You're right. You're right.
So it's about a young woman played by Kiersey Clemons who ends up on this island with, I don't remember whether she washes up with two of her friends or whether she like ends up on this island with two strangers who also washed up.
It's
in a separate accident.
It has it both ways in a way that I kind of admired. She's Robinson Crusoeing for the first half of the movie and then finds two other survivors of the same wreck. And I think she is acquainted with both of them.
That's right.
Although the guy and she are not simpatico. They're not friends.
No. There is some kind of, at least for the first half of the movie or two-thirds or so, there is an unseen force, some kind of presumably non-human antagonist that is prowling. And it turns out basically that there's just a monster that swims around the island and then at night comes up on land and is hungry. And it's really nothing more complicated than that. The movie's like a tight 78 minutes plus credits. And it's basically just those three characters plus the monster. And yeah, I mean, it's a lot of fun. Really, all that it has to do with old is that you have the beach setting and a lot of it takes place during the day. But given that this is a horror podcast, I would say Sweetheart is more of a true blue horror movie than old is.
Yeah,
fear of aging notwithstanding.
Yeah, you're not wrong about that. So much of the danger in Sweetheart comes from the fact that when she does reconnect with the other castaways, they don't believe that there's a monster. They think, oh, Sweetheart, you're being hysterical. Calm down. Gets very gaslighty. So that's sort of what the movie is about thematically, and I thought that aspect of it was kind of half-baked, and that's why I'm lukewarm on the movie overall. The fact that it's in the title makes it seem like it was like a real priority for the filmmakers, but it just didn't bring anything new to the table in that department, I thought. However, the actual like monster on the prowl stuff is pretty good, and on those merits, the movie is definitely worth a watch.
Yeah. So, Picnic at Hanging Rock and Sweetheart.
You got it.
There's your homework.
Uh-huh.
I think that'll wrap things up this time around. So until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from old official trailer HD, uploaded by Universal Pictures. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, September 5th, and we will be discussing Don't Breathe 2, a bewilderingly unjustified sequel to the 2016 film. See you then.